Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the first of two episodes in conversation with Canberra-based poet Melinda Smith. Plus, The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Melinda Smith's several poetry collections include the 2014 Prime Minister's Literary Award-winning Drag Down to Unlock or Place an Emergency Call. Among her other books are Goodbye Cruel, Pitt Street Poetry, 2017, the chapbook Listen Bitch, with artist Karen Florence, Recent Work Press, 2019, and Manhandled, also from Recent Work Press in 2020. She frequently collaborates with artists in other disciplines, including visual artists, and is former poetry editor at the Canberra Times. As we will hear, some of her poetry is a searing indictment of gendered contempt and violence, but she's also humorous and compassionate in her view of human nature. We began by asking Melinda Smith to outline her career in poetry.
So I was a late starter, if you like. Probably got going in my late 20s to writing poetry, and since then I've kind of produced, I suppose, 7 original books and 1 greatest hits, if you like. There was a long hiatus. I had 3 books in quick succession up until 2004, and then I had kids got in the way, and then I kind of brought out books in 2012 and 2013 and 2017 and 2020, I think, and I got a couple in 2017. Yeah.
So if we could go back just to your late 20s, what took you to poetry?
People always laugh when I tell them this. I wanted to get away from footnotes. I was doing a PhD, which I didn't finish. I did 1 year of a PhD in Japanese history, of all things. And I just wanted to write something that I didn't have to footnote, that came from me rather than from somebody else. Because as you know, when you write a PhD, a lot of the text is just you summarizing what other people have said so that you can agree with it or disagree with it. So I was actually at Cambridge because I got a scholarship to go and do this PhD on Japanese history in Cambridge. That's a whole other conversation, but they had a really good library, and the world expert on what I was working on was there. But they had also a bunch of kind of really cool adult education offerings through the uni, and I did a kind of creative writing one at nighttime just for fun, and we wrote lots of different genres. We did like one genre a week, and the one that stuck with me was poetry. And so from then I just kept just writing, you know, in odd moments and keeping the notes, and eventually sent one out maybe the following year, and it came second in something, and I thought, oh, okay, maybe I'm okay at this. And then I like never won anything else for years and years after that, but it was very encouraging.
That's really what you need, is just that little go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. This gives me a few places I want to go. I want to talk about how Japan influences your work, because it's so clearly there. Mm-hmm. But actually, before we do that, I wanted to talk about it. It's interesting for me to hear you say that about footnotes, because so much of your writing is playful and uses form outside of poetic form. I'm thinking, for example, of Manhandled and the part called Listen Bitch, right, where you're taking actual quotes from other people and weaving them into the lines. Just to clarify, here we're talking about Melinda's poem, Listen Bitch, which is built from various obnoxious comments powerful men have made about women.
Yeah, so that's me taking back footnotes and making them fun, I think. Yeah, because particularly, yeah, if you look at, say, Goodbye Cruel and Manhandled and Listen Bitch, they're nothing but footnotes at the end. So clearly I got over my footnote aversion somewhere along the line. But what I just feel like they have a purpose in those poems, particularly the ones in Listen Bitch. It's like I kept receipts. That's like, okay, so maybe not all men, maybe men don't all think like this, maybe men don't all speak like this, but this man on this day spoke like this, and I kept the receipt, and it's in a footnote at the, you know, back of the book, and that way you can't deny that part of the reality of, I don't know, being a woman and living the air where public figures are allowed to say really bizarre things.
It was confronting. And I found it interesting because as I was reading through that part, through Listen, Bitch, and I was reading it sequentially, I found it harder and harder to get through.
Yeah.
And then I read the part in the back where you said you arranged it that way on purpose, that it becomes more and more violent as you go.
Mm. Yeah. By the end, you should want to, well, I don't know, rock in a corner or punch something. It's a necessary, well, it was a necessary book for me to write, but it is quite tough going for the reader. So yeah, people have to look after themselves when they read that book, I think, and probably should have bigger trigger warnings on the front.
I wonder, did this book get lost? This is Recent Work Press, right? Did it get lost at all in COVID because it was 2020?
Yeah, it did a bit. I was kind of booked to go to a few writers' festivals that ended up dying. So it's a shame because I'm quite proud of that particular book. But poetry is a long game and, you know, you'd never give up hope that somebody might find something of yours, you know, in a Lifeline book fair 25 years after you write it. That's the whole point of it, is not really to get on all the front pages immediately, but to just leave little breadcrumbs out there for people to find, hopefully.
Melinda Smith clarified further what her collections, Listen, Bitch, and Manhandled are.
So we're kind of talking about two books interchangeably here, which is probably a bit confusing.
Yeah.
So Listen, Bitch came first. It's a little chapbook, like a small mini poetry book. And it's just poems on kind of misogyny and misogynist language. Some of them are arranged in quite visually interesting ways. And I involved my book designer, book artist, co-collaborator, co-conspirator, Karen Florence, to help me. So the Listen, Bitch book has actually got on it by Melinda Smith and Karen Florence, because she helped me with a lot of the visual aspects of that. And yeah, that's... and then later on, Manhandled was like the full-length collection that I had been working on, and Listen, Bitch slotted in and became one of the sections of Manhandled, rearranged slightly.
And
so,
both books are Recent Work Press.
And both books are from Recent Work Press, yes.
Poetry on the Radio's Peter Searles asked.
They deal with gendered violence.
Yeah.
And, well, it says somewhere in the acknowledgements that you said that it's been called your angriest book. I'm talking about Manhandled now.
Yes, yeah.
And definitely as a reader, there's a lot of anger coming to it as well. But I also noticed the other section in Manhandled, The Space Within His Fist, called. I was just noting a calmness in that section. It was more maybe an interrogation of masculinity, and it wasn't anger I was getting from that. So I was wondering how it is for you dealing with this subject matter and writing about it emotionally.
Thank you for that question. That's a very good question. So, you know, what I love about poetry is it can hold multitudes, and it, whenever I write about a subject, I try and write about it from lots of different points of view and lots of different angles, because that's how I move myself towards an understanding of something, and hopefully the reader gets some of that journey as well. And so, you know, there was an angry set of poems in that book, but also a set of poems where I try and take a compassionate and curious view about what it's like to be a man in a man's body. And obviously it's something I can only ever understand secondhand, but, you know, I have two sons, you know, had a partner who was a man, and, you know, I have kind of skin in that game. So it's important, you know, if we all want to get better at this thing of being human, to try and understand each other and see things from different perspectives. And so, yeah, the attitude, I suppose, of those poems in The Space Inside His Fist was, you know, what about living as a man can cause such distress that it turns outwards in violence, and it turns outwards in things that impact women terribly. You know, how do we understand the wound that might be there? And, you know, how do we go about thinking how to heal it? So that's where those poems came from. And yeah, having more than one attitude to something is very helpful for me, because you can get stuck. You can start to spiral if you just keep thinking about something from one perspective.
Melinda Smith read from the books we've been discussing.
This poem, Sweetheart, is composed of misogynist statements made by public figures, mostly in the 90s. And I should give a shout out to the project that helped make this book possible, which is the Ernie Awards, which have been going since, I think, 1994, and were started by a bunch of Sydney women unionists who got very sick of the nonsense that they often heard from male trade unionists. And so they started kind of keeping receipts, keeping score, and then they expanded out to not just, you know, the trade union movement, but the media, politics, you know, judicial figures, anyone who had a public platform and was saying egregiously misogynist things. And then they give an award for the worst one every year. And these were some nominees from the 90s, some of whom, if you're old enough, you might recognise. Sweetheart, you don't need a model to work this one out. If you take out uncovered meat and place it outside on the street and the cats come and eat it, whose fault is it, the cats or the uncovered meat? The GST will greatly affect the workers of Australia and their wives. Hairy-legged femocrats, they will abort a baby just because it is inconvenient or summer is approaching and they want to wear a bikini. There is, of course, nothing wrong with a husband faced with his wife's initial refusal to engage in intercourse in attempting, in an acceptable way, to persuade her to change her mind, and that may involve rougher than usual handling. Sweetheart, you don't need a model to work this one out. The simple solution is to prohibit all females from using these machines. I should actually say who we heard in there. Yeah. So that was in order, John Dawkins, who was the federal treasurer at the time, Sheikh Taj el-Din el-Hilali, who was Mufti of Australia at the time, Tim Fisher, who was Deputy Prime Minister at the time, Martin Ferguson, ACTU President, Ian McLean, who was WA Liberal MP, Justice Derek Bolan from the South Australian Supreme Court, that was the rougher than usual handling material, and the Reverend Fred Nile on how to solve the Big Dipper roller coaster noise problem at Sydney's Luna Park. Okay, so to balance that one out, his heart on the outside, slightly adult themes, but I'm assuming most of the listeners are adult. His heart, so this is from that other section, the space inside his fist, and takes a bit of a different view. His heart on the outside. He wishes it were armoured. He is always afraid of being kicked in it. It still speaks to him, but he has unlearned its language. Soft, nestled, veined syllables he cannot catch. He likes to give it slightly more space than it actually needs. Facing any kind of reckoning, he shields it and will not be answerable. He persists in thinking that in its default state, limp, indifferent, it is of the slightest interest whatsoever. When it stirs, unfurls, fills with sap, it is magnificent, but still only potentially important. It is only when he surrenders it, yields it up, that it can change anything at all. It must bloom mutely in a small pocket of disputed territory, like a trumpet flower, a marrow blossom, like a bound wound unwinding as a white flag. And you can't see this on the radio, obviously, but there's kind of visual joke in the way that the poem is set out on the page.
The shape of the poem.
Karen, when she was designing this for me, called it the bag of dicks.
That's something that I notice in your poetry. A little bit across the board, no matter what book I'm reading, but especially in this one and in Drag Down to Unlock, the topics of the poems can be quite serious, as we've already said, quite confronting, and yet in the midst of it all, you're playing. It is your playfulness is so delightful. It's so unexpected. And I think it does serve kind of as a foil sometimes to what you're writing about. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I suppose it, you know, at an intellectual level, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And I really, what was it? Was it Shelley? Somebody who said, we are always suspicious of poetry that has designs upon us. And I might have designs upon the reader, but I feel like if I'm going to have designs upon the reader, I might as well make it fun for them. But also just, you know, it's a personality thing. That's just, life can be very dark, but the asteroid's coming anyway. We might as well have a good time in amongst the darkness. So, So I don't know which is actually takes primacy, the intellectual or the emotional angle on that. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff I write.
You're saying that, this may sound really bizarre, but I think of my two cats grappling. Maybe it's not one or the other, but it's the way they grapple.
The way they grapple, yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite poems in the book is one that's a little bit different, Marks. I've always got this interest in things from the past. And in this case, this is a very archival poem. Would you explain it a little?
Yeah. This is one for the archival nerds.
That'd be me.
And yeah, I love looking at old documents and the stories that are written in them and the stories that are between the lines as well are fascinating to me. And I went through a big phase actually in a book before this, Goodbye Cruel, where I spent a lot of time in Trove looking at old newspaper articles and getting stories out of them or characters out of them or ideas for poems. And this is also a poem from Trove. So Trove, I'm sure most listeners know, it's a wonderful database that the National Library makes available online for free, and you can search up a bunch of historical material in there. The most fun for me is the old newspaper articles that go back to, you know, the 19th century. But there are lots of other rarer documents in there, and this is one of them. It's based on a page of the diary that Lieutenant William Bligh wrote in while he was on the Bounty. Well, sorry, just after he'd been put off the Bounty after the mutiny. And he was noting down the distinguishing features of the Bounty mutineers so that maybe one day if his account were found, they could be brought to justice. And I just thought, it was amazing that this had survived and it was in our archives and anyone could go and look at William Bligh's handwriting. And also just thinking about the circumstances in which it was written, you know, the anger and the frustration, and it's a very human thing. It's like, oh, those, they'll get it. I'll write down everything and I'll keep receipts. And
I'll show you.
I'll show you people and justice will be done. It's a very also kind of settler colonial attitude as well. It's like, if all I have to do is write this down and the system will defend me. And so those ideas kind of come together, and it starts off with William Bligh writing things down, and the poem has like tables in it because he has a bunch of ideas about how to describe people, and they kind of fall into categories. And then the poem kind of takes a left turn and thinks about where he is in the Pacific Ocean and what the Bounty was doing in the Pacific Ocean and how that might have been impacting other people and how they might have felt about it and what receipts they might have wanted to keep. So all of that, yeah, and it looks weird on the page because of all the tables and bits of text. Yeah.
You've got the text on the left.
Yeah.
The tables are what I would call a chart.
Yes.
On the right.
On the right, yeah.
And, you know, so we've got the names, the ages, the height.
Marks, or Lieutenant William Bligh notes the distinguishing features of the Bounty mutineers. It is given to so few of us, this clarity. Fletcher Christian, age 24 years, 5'9" high, complexion dark and very swarthy, hair blackish or very dark brown, make strong marks, star tattooed on the left breast and on the backside. His knees stands a little out and may be called a little bow-legged. They have left him his pen. He is making a kind of ledger, scratching at the bitter pages as if these columns will ever balance. George Stewart, aged 23 years, 5'7" high, has the small face and black eyes of all your bad luck, scurrying straight at you, a rat across a mooring rope. He will make proper account, for there will be a reckoning. Adrift though he is, he will tally the blackguards like stolen cargo, like the lost breadfruit seedlings, months and months of His Majesty's work thrown into the sea. Peter Haywood, aged 17, 5'7", and well proportioned, had not done growing. As if such a wound, such a theft, is ever done growing. His Manx accent will convict him, apparently, that, and his three-legged tattoo. The Pacific has blotted the ink. We will never know whether Edward Young, age 22, stood 5'1" or 5'7", but he remains dark of complexion, strong of make, has rather a bad look, has lost several of his foreteeth, and those that remain are all rotten. This clarity given to so few, this certainty that what was lost on this day, at this hour, at the hands of a man with a small mole on the left side of the throat. Did the chiefs of Otaheite keep their own ledger of thieves, dealers in bad faith, liars? Did they note somewhere each particular indignity? So many women kidnapped, so many houses burned, so many canoes, so many balances of power left hold, left listing. The grandmothers must have, surely, inside their implacable heads. The litany of wounds, of thefts, is never done growing. They have always known when someone commandeers your only vessel, sails it clean away, the recital of each imperfection may be all the lifeboat that is left to you. How it can then become a matter of utmost importance that the perpetrator is subject to violent perspiration, and particularly in his hands, so that he soils anything he handles.
The historical focus of that poem takes me then to think about another book, Members Only, which is one of your collaborations with Karen Florence. And while we're doing our best to describe what's very visual, would you just tell us a bit about what Members Only is about and how it appears?
Yes.
How it works.
Thank you for asking about this book. I'm very fond of this one. And I am delighted to see that the Museum of Australian Democracy, which is basically the institution that gave birth to this book, they still have it in their gift shop. So it's very kind of them to support it in this way too. It's a book that came out of a residency that I did with Karen Florence. It was part of an idea that the Museum of Australian Democracy had to kind of activate their collections. And they got involved with Craft ACT, and they got people who are members of Craft ACT, which Karen was, to apply to see if they could respond to different articles of furniture in Old Parliament House. And it was called the Bespoke Design for the People exhibition. So it actually was an exhibition first. And the article of furniture that Karen and I chose, because we applied kind of as a team, but under her auspices, was old-fashioned wooden hand-painted signs that can be seen in Old Parliament House. And most of them got gold lettering, and some of them got little hands pointing on them, which I learned through this book are called manicules. And I love that word and the little hands pointing so much that they're on the cover of the book as well. And so because it was kind of out of an exhibition, it was quite a visual project, but because it involved signs, it involved words. And so I worked with Karen. I took all the words off all the signs. There were about eight of them in their little collection that they had. And I just printed them, like typed them out, printed them out, cut them up and made new signs, but only from those words that existed. And they made, strange semi-poems. And then those were displayed in Old Parliament House. And you can see the photo on the back cover of the kind of the end result, which is us doing an exhibition of these signs. And they had things like the point of the present is not to be the past, was like one of the signs. And yeah, I'm not going to read them all out for you, but there's those signs kind of had a bit of a life of their own as an art exhibition, and they were exhibited in a few other places. And then as kind of a culmination of the project, we decided to write some more material to go around the signs. And Karen produced a great big artist's book, which is held in the National Library now and in a couple of other collections. I think the State Library of New South Wales has one. And we also produced a chapbook, like a take-home $10 version of the $1,000 artist's book. And that's what this is. We did, again, playing with a lot of words around Parliament House, Wikipedia articles about the design of old Parliament House, anagram poems of interesting themes that came out through our research. You know, there's an anagram poem of television, there's an anagram poem of housewives. As we honed in on how we were going to make this book, we decided to focus on 1 year. And so we focused on 1962, because that was the first year that even if you were a First Nations Australian, you had the right to vote in all federal elections wherever you were. Up until that point, you could only vote if your state allowed you to vote in federal elections. So it was really the first year that the parliament was in any sense truly representative of everybody living on this continent. So we figured, well, let's take a snapshot of 1962. And, you know, there was a Cuban Missile Crisis and there was all sorts of other random things that happened that year. And so some of the other things that come into this book are chunks of Hansard that have been kind of worked into poems. So it's this very kind of, it's visually influenced by Parliament House. It's got like Parliament House design elements all through it. But it's also like hearing the voices of 1962. So when you read the book, it's like hearing this cacophony of strange voices, like a radio jammed between two stations. But a lot of it is, you know, things that were said in the building in 1962 and manipulations of those. So that's, I've basically talked for as long as it would take me to read the whole book out.
How long did it take you and Karen to, how long did you work on this project? And
so the residency was at the end of 2014 and the signs were up for a whole year. So up for most of 2015 in Old Parliament House as part of the exhibition. And yeah, so we kind of worked throughout 2015 and 2016 on bringing these words together and did, I can remember it was a really hot summer and we spent a fair bit of time in Karen's studio. She obviously printed the whole artist book in her letterpress studio and had, you know, the physically grueling end of it. I just showed up a couple of times and kind of played around with bits of text. Yeah, and I think, so the whole thing would have been finished maybe by the end of 2016 and, you know, came out as a actual publication in 2017.
Next week, we'll hear Melinda Smith read from the book she's just introduced, Members Only, which appeared from Recent Work Press in 2017.
The Rhyming Bugle. On August 14 at Smith's Alternative in Civic at 7:30, That Poetry Thing presents Ellen Shelley and Peter Robinson. Ellen Shelley's poetry has appeared in the Canberra Times, Cordite, Australian Poetry, Rabbit, Australian Poetry Anthology, Westerly, and other publications. Peter Robinson is a journalist, actor, playwright, comedian, and songwriter whose novel, The Nun's Tale, appeared in 2012 under the pseudonym Pei Robin and whose poetry collection will too. On August 28, That Poetry Thing will host a big open mic. And here's advance word that on September 25, a Monday at Smith's Alternative at 7 p.m, The Book of Birds, an anthology of bird-related poems edited by Leyland and Lebkowitz, will be launched. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Molyneux. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Sounds and Sweet Airs by English trumpeter Ian Carr. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.